Hello everyone and welcome to another special episode of Taking Stock After the Bell. We're live at the FT Weekend Festival here with the splendid backdrop of Kenwood House behind us. James and I are absolutely thrilled to have Katie Martin with us. Katie is the markets columnist for the Financial Times and she writes the weekly Longview column and is also the host of their weekly podcast. So we actually have a professional podcast host on, which is pretty terrifying for me, I'll have you know. I'm also a little bit starstruck having been a long-time Twitter slash X user. Katie has been a long-standing FinTwit contributor, but has now unfortunately retired from said platform.
It's no fun anymore, no.
Has made me somewhat sad.
Sorry.
light up my days for years, I might say. So we thought we'd get her on. We sort of touched on the last podcast that you may or may not have seen so far about markets, what's been going on, you know, what's been driving our conversations internally. And I think the first thing, Katie, really, you were next door on the FT Money stage hosting a sort of conflab around UK equities and what can the government do. I mean, it's kind of a live issue for our clients because the portfolios we run will have equities. Mm-hmm. Some will have a bias to UK equities relative to a sort of global benchmark. And obviously UK equities have been through a pretty, you know, fair to say, disappointing performance period over the last 5-10 years. Should clients be kind of giving up on the UK and going global, or is now actually the time that UK equities, you think, could be really interesting for investors?
It's really tricky. So, you know, there's lots of investment banks and investment managers out there who are saying, look, now is the time to buy UK. It is cheap. I've never seen it so cheap in all my born days. You know, you compare it to the US markets in particular, valuations are incredibly attractive. The problem is they've been incredibly attractive for a really long time, and sometimes cheap things get cheaper and sometimes things are cheap for a reason. Yeah. That said, there's a couple of reasons to think that it is time for people to take a bit of a fresh look at the UK. One reason for that is that big tech is really coming off the boil, particularly in the US. And, you know, what's the opposite of big tech? It's all the kind of, frankly, very boring companies that are listed in the UK. You know, the miners, the banks, tobacco companies, you know. That's the sort of stuff that people gravitate towards in a situation where they think interest rates are likely to fall and where they think that some of the speculative froth is coming off other bits of the market. Now, you know, that speculative froth has done an awful lot of hard work in dragging up the US market, in dragging up global markets. It's having a bit of a tricky time at the moment. Some of the big US names are struggling somewhat from a really high base, but they're struggling.
Well,
they're having done incredible. You know, if you've ridden the US tech trend up, congratulations, pat yourself on the back. You've had a great run. But to the extent that this does seem now to be coming slightly off the boil, that the market has decided, hang on, this stuff is really expensive now, you know, it is time to look at more kind of value-oriented markets, and the UK is cheap and it is super value-oriented.
Yeah, and that sort of bias to resources in particular, I think if you take the oils and the mining sector, you get nearly 20% of the index of the market as a whole. It's very, you know, it's very China-oriented. Commodity prices generally dance to whatever happening in China, and the news from there has not been pretty, it's fair to say. Any sense that might change? Is everyone too down on China? What do people tell you? I mean, you sit all day and talk to guys from across the city and across the world. I mean, what generally is the feedback on that?
Well, one thing that a couple of bankers actually mentioned to me the other day that I need to look at in a little bit more detail is actually, so global stock markets have been having a tough time for the past sort of week or 10 days. Some of the sectors that are doing particularly badly, particularly in Europe, are actually a China trade.
Yeah.
If you look at European luxury, if you look at, you know, booze, if you look at consumer, if you look at sort of China-facing industries in Europe, they are having a bit of a tough time, and they've ridden the China, you know, the China wave up, and they're riding it back down again.
Yeah.
We have seen a little bit of weakness in Chinese PMIs. I think fund managers are coming around to the view that, look, we kind of thought this tricky patch that China had was just down to the well-publicized issues with the housing market, which is like a quarter or a third of the economy or something like that. What if it's actually something deeper? What if this deglobalization thing that everyone's been talking about since COVID, manufacturing leaving China and getting spread more evenly around the world, what if that is really in play here? And so there is much more of a nervousness around China that is crystallising in certain bits of the European markets that I think is worth taking seriously.
Yeah. It's strange because that is happening, but at the same time the DAX in Germany is actually hitting all-time highs, and that's kind of quite a big China-exposed market.
But there was the VW shut a factory, didn't they, last week in Germany, and some of that was electric vehicle weakness and stuff, but that's all kind of tied up in that China story.
And you've got a very, you've got an increasingly accommodative central bank over there in the form of the European Central Bank, so there's lots of competing forces at play. But I do think, you know, I was talking to a few people towards the start of this year who were saying, well, might just dip a little bit of a toe back into China. Maybe some of this has been overdone. They've gone very quiet.
And to be fair, we've got, you know, we have an overweight EM, and part of that would be China exposure. Yes, we have India with it and South Korea and other areas, but the China part has definitely continued to hurt. I think, you know, if you turn the clock back a couple of years or 18 months, that unlocking of China, the market got really excited that was going to be consumers coming out and spending. And that's what we can't figure out is actually the savings levels look quite good from a consumer point of view, but the Chinese person is not spending that. I think the government's, it feels like they're struggling to get them to spend, but I don't know, what's your take on that?
They've got a deflation problem or a disinflation problem, and you know, we haven't experienced that for quite a long time, but that can be really quite corrosive. So it would certainly help sentiment in global markets if China could turn this around, and currently that's not really happening. And it's funny that when you talk about EM strategies, when I talk to people about EM strategies, they're talking about EMX China.
It's a new thing,
there kind of is no EMX China, but like, you know, that's a strategy that's become increasingly kind of popular, and Asia ex China. You know, back in the day it was always Asia ex Japan, because Japan had blown up and let's just never touch it or think about it or speak about it ever again. That's turned around somewhat. But suddenly strategies ex China are a thing. And I think there's much more nervousness about getting your fingers burnt in China again now. So I think, you know, my impression from talking to fund managers is that they would need a lot to convince them that this can turn around.
Probably need some evidence that things are getting better at the margin before you start. And markets will move, but you know, maybe you'd be happy to miss the initial move if you think that it's actually got traction.
And there's this big thing hanging over them, which is Donald Trump. And you know, both the Democrats and the Republicans have both got really a fairly tough, aggressive stance towards China, but Trump's is more obviously, let's say, idiosyncratic and unpredictable. Mm. So that's also like a risk that people would want to see cleared out of the way, I think.
I mean, going back to the UK again, actually when you look at the world and you think, you know, the US economy is slowing, valuations of the companies are rich. And look, we, you know, the US is the largest exposure we have within our equity portfolios, but, you know, some of the US looks fine, but, you know, we all know the stocks that are more expensive because the growth comes with it, admittedly. But, you know, we've talked about some concerns about China and Asia and maybe Europe. I mean, is the UK actually, from an economic and valuation point of view, maybe looking like the outlier in terms of, I mean, we're massive, you know, we keep banging the drum for the FTSE 100, but I mean, maybe it is a time for the UK to have a bit more.
Yeah, I mean, I was writing about this in today's paper. You know, a lot of markets around the world have had a very difficult start to September. The UK's had a kind of okay start to September. You know, it's not down anywhere near as much as the other markets. And that's because it has this powerful shield of boringness that other markets lack, you know, because it's stuffed with the sorts of companies that you've described that are not quite so sensitive to these kind of ebbs and flows. So it has got a bit of that kind of island of stability about it. The other thing is, I was really struck around the time of the UK election at the start of July that the minute there was a result and the minute we knew what the result was, there were some really big investment houses. You know, you look at BlackRock, you look at others that were like, right, we're overweight UK. Mm. We're looking for opportunities in UK, because what they can see is, you know, whatever your politics, they can see stability. There's a massive majority. Yeah. It's not the party that previously blew up the bond market. It's, you know, you don't have to be in love with its fiscal program or with anything else in terms of, you know, politically as a government. But people can see stability, they can see there's a plan, and investors really like that. And they can see loads of opportunities in green technology, in infrastructure, in housing, in stuff that the Labour Party has described, the new Labour government has described as priorities. You know, there's a lot there, and there's quite a few, you know, big fund management houses that I've spoken to that have said, you give me some details around this green infrastructure stuff and I'm in. I will sign this stuff. This is, there is money to be made in this. It's not just a kind of virtual signaling thing. It's, this is an infrastructure project that I believe in.
And it's worth mentioning to the listeners who might not be aware, but the largest owners of the UK market, sadly, actually are international investors. It's not the domestic investor anymore. So, you know, when the likes of BlackRock and foreign investors do come in, they move markets.
The thing that people really need to remember about UK markets that often gets overlooked is it's perfectly rational for international investors to completely ignore us.
3% of the global equity market.
We're what, 2.something% of the MSCI Global. That was about 5% in 2010, if I remember rightly. It's perfectly rational not to have a view on the UK. We really just don't matter as much as we think.
And in truth, they haven't. When Brexit happened, and whether you know you're in favour or not, I think as an international investor, it was too complicated.
It was too much, yeah.
And you just, you know, as you say, if it was 15% of MSCI or 10%, everyone would have to have a view. But because it was so little, as you say, you can ignore it.
You can totally ignore it.
It's a shame though, because I always think there's a good cohort of really good quality global businesses. AstraZeneca, RELX, which is mentioned next door, Compass, Experian, you know, Diageo to a degree. We've got some really cracking businesses, but unfortunately, the middle part of the market is not, and those businesses probably aren't rewarded well enough for the quality that they are compared to international peers.
Yeah.
And that kind of drags the whole market down a little bit. I mean, I take your point. The stability thing is interesting when you see what's happening in France in particular, but also in Germany and Europe as a whole. So, you know, maybe investors are beginning to come out of the market. And you're right, it's done pretty well in the last month.
But the other point that's worth mentioning is that, you know, yes, the UK is like a shrinking part of the global MSCI pie. But in addition, UK pensions have just backed away from equities.
I was going to ask you about this.
This is what we were just talking about in the session about you know, how to revitalise UK markets. The UK pension system used to be about 50% allocated to equities. Yeah. It's now 4%.
Pretty much all UK equities as well, in 20 years ago, 25 years ago.
And it's now, I think it's 4.4%. You know, this is a massive shift. The problem is that within that, if you look at equity exposure as a whole among UK pensions, they're about 18% of their equity exposure is in UK. So in a sense, they're massively overweight UK. In a sense, they're massively underweight UK. They're massively underweight equities. And so one of the things that, you know, people across the city are trying to do now is incentivize through like accountancy changes and through tax changes and this and that, really trying to get UK pensions much more involved in equity markets.
Because that's what happens in the States, right? They have their 401k plans, which are effectively the same as our personal pension plans. Money goes into theirs every 2 weeks or every 4 weeks, and they just buy the S&P 500, they buy Microsoft, and they buy Amazon, and the money just flows in. Doesn't seem to happen to the same degree in the UK.
We just don't have an equity culture in this country. And, you know, again, the kind of great and the good in the city at the Exchange and elsewhere are like hugely focused on the task of developing more of an equity culture in the UK. But there's, I mean, where do you start? There's an awful lot that has to change to make that a reality. But I don't buy the argument that Brits are somehow uniquely risk averse. We bet on the football. We bet on the football in the middle of matches. You know, it's who's going to score the next goal. There is a huge number of people who punted on crypto over the years.
It's never mattered historically, because UK, I mean, I totally agree. And the reason I agree is that historically, UK equity market performance tracked global market performance. And then sometimes it beat it, sometimes it underperformed, until 2015, 2016, when it totally diverged. So we haven't changed in that time. You know, so we do have an equity culture. you're right though, we do have a gambling culture and we should have an equity culture.
Yeah.
How do
yeah.
we get, how do
the
we...
The thing is that, you know, if you open up, you know, whatever app that it is that you use and you say, okay, you know, I've got some money, I want to park it away in some stocks, what's the first thing that comes up is, how about some Tesla? How about some Nvidia? How about this, that and the other US stock? Look how well it's done over the past few years. And we just don't have kind of big brand companies that we feel a kind of almost emotional attachment to, like Apple, for example.
Apple's a classic example.
You know, what you can buy British American Tobacco, you know,
if you love dividends,
absolutely knock yourself out. Take some
of those, put in your ISA.
But, you know, it's just not the same, it's not the same culture, and that is a really hard thing to fix, actually.
Yeah. And then on that, I mean, we mentioned, touched a little bit, you know, big tech has sort of had a rough month or so, led by the poster child Nvidia. Is that over, do you think? What's the consensus? What are the feedback you're hearing?
So, rewind a little bit, right? Nvidia put out some earnings numbers. They were like...
It's a global event. I was watching CNBC at 9 p.m. on a Wednesday night. I mean, my wife was thrilled.
Yes, thrilled. You really need to get out more. But, it was a big deal. You know, Nvidia, biggest company in the world. You know, it's added however many trillions in market value over the course of this year. You know, it's a huge, great big deal. It puts out its numbers. The numbers are fantastic. Mm. It made $30 billion or something over the quarter. It was just, it's an absolute runaway success. But then it also said, okay, our outlook for the next quarter is, well, you know, 30 something billion. And the market was like, I was sort of hoping you'd say a little bit more than that. It's like, what do you want, blood? Like, this is completely ridiculous. So at first I thought, this is the short-term tech guys being irrational and just having overly lofty expectations. Now the dust has settled on it a bit, I'm more thinking, you know what, that stock's had a really good run and it can't just keep doubling every 9 months because at some point logic kicks in, and unless this is going to be like a $20 trillion company by the end of next year, this pace of change in the stock simply doesn't make sense. So the stock's come off about, 10% over the course of September so far. That's a chunk of change.
Well, it's a lot of market cap terms.
Because it's just such a big company. But the stock's still up 80% this year or something. You know, like, this thing isn't crashing. And unless AI is just a load of old rubbish after all, then it's not going to crash as such. Mm.
Is AI a load of old rubbish? No, that is the crux of the question.
All I know is my personal experience of using AI things is that they are rubbish. Like, you know, the more kind of day-to-day exposure I have to these things. Oh, allow me to summarise this email. Why? Allow me to write this text for you. Like, why? Like, I just don't... That's not what I want to write.
Very fair.
I don't... So...
I think it's... I mean, we sort of integrating Copilot into work a bit. And whilst it's not perfect, you can see that there is the real potential there to make our lives a lot easier.
I think if you're a coder, or for example, if like some investment management firms that I speak to, they receive just like truckloads of sell-side research every day, and AI to read it.
We open our email, you know, the emails get opened at probably 6:30 on the train, and you've got, as you say, from sell-side, we've got emails that deep.
So the sell-side use AI to write a 100-page report on Nvidia, and the buy-side use AI to distill a 100-page report down to what,
moral of the story, buy Nvidia, buy the arms makers, right? Yeah. But. There are some real utilities there. And like, so for example, my son just did his GCSEs, did okay, not great, did okay. But one of the things he did when he was revising his maths, and he would go on to like ChatGPT and say, look at all of the past papers from the past 5 years and write me a dummy paper for tomorrow. What's going to be in the paper tomorrow? And it will spit out all these questions for you, and then he'll say, okay, that's a little bit easy, make it harder. Or that's a little bit hard, make it easier.
Wow.
Or I need more practice on that. Can you give me another question that's similar? And I'm like,
pretty interesting.
You are actually using the internet to good effect. That sounds like good AI. That's better AI than my phone trying to tell me what to write in my text messages. So, I mean, what do I know? I don't know. But I do know there's a lot of hope and expectation built into these valuations. And at some point, and this is what the market is doing now, it's just standing back and saying, hang on a second, yeah, does this actually make sense?
Which I think is perfectly rational, because you know, the multiple it's on, you know, we know, you know, the multiple probably makes sense if they can carry on growing at the predicted growth rates,
yeah,
but we know the hyperscalers at some stage will stop buying the same amount of GPUs. It's,
yeah,
it's just what, you know, yeah, you know, chips are cyclical.
And it's just not healthy to have that much key man risk, right? That much kind of single name stock exposure. And you know, the only way to beat the market this year has been to overweight stocks that are already in and of themselves 7% of the S&P in some cases. This kind of concentration, what we're seeing now is what happens when that goes wrong. And, you know, it was pretty inevitable this would come at some point. So, you know, I was wrong the first time when I said this is a load of fuss about nothing, let's just ignore it. So I'm reluctant now to say, you know, to guess how much further it has to run. But there's definitely been a shift in the tone. There was something in the water that wasn't there three or four weeks ago.
I think that's a fair observation. In the last month, I don't want to get into specific, the Japanese yen carry trade for the sake of our audiences.
But yeah, that shock we had at the start of August, maybe it was
just a sort of precursor to a little bit more. Because the yen has carried on strengthening since then. And it's gone back to those sort of levels at 140. And then we had, you know, yesterday, I think the other sort of talking point in the markets in the last month or so is, are we going to have a recession in the US on farm payrolls yesterday? If you thought that we were having a soft landing yesterday, didn't really help your cause. If you thought the US economy was doing fine, you might set an alarm bell off. Unemployment is rising, things are loosening. Yeah. We've had COVID, which in itself is a really weird cycle.
It's
not a typical economic cycle. We talked about that with Dario Perkins, who came on with us a year ago, and he was exactly that. Don't read anything into the cycle because it's not normal.
Yeah.
But you look at the numbers weakening and you think, ooh.
Yeah, so what we've seen is that, you know, the US economy continues to add jobs, but not at the same pace that it was previously. And we've seen enough shaky payrolls numbers now to lead you to reasonably conclude that something is going on.
Mm.
These, like, you know, in my previous job at the Wall Street Journal, whenever payrolls came through, we'd have a sweepstake in the office. Because it's such, even way before COVID, it was such a hard number to guess. No one ever gets payrolls right. So, you know, I wouldn't worry too much about the specific numbers here, but it's the direction of travel that is spooking the market.
Totally.
And so what we're seeing now is a debate around not does the Fed cut this month, because
it's going to cut.
They've signaled it's coming and they tend to like to do what they've said. So a cut is coming. But what we're starting to get a bit more of a sense of through what the FOMC members are saying, what the rate setters are saying is, you know, maybe half a percentage point does make sense.
Yeah.
Now, I find it really hard to believe that they will go straight into a rate cutting cycle with a half a point cut.
Because
it says, Houston, we have a problem.
Yeah.
You know, whatever the kind of rights and wrongs of it, kind of economically, the message is, oh, lads, we've screwed this up. We've kept rates too high for too long. We need to scarper back. So my hunch is, look, maybe they will still do a half a point cut this year, but I just can't see them doing it as the first move.
Well, they did however many 3/4 of a percentage point rises on the way, didn't they? But I take your point. They'd rather not. I just wonder if they might and sort of say, well, okay, rates have been high, it's been a funny cycle, we're going to get back to normalisation sooner rather than later. I don't know. We'll see, but, you know,
a couple of weeks ago, I'd have said that you were bonkers
if
you thought that. Now I'm like, I know there are some hedge funds out there that are saying, I think it makes sense to take a punt on this.
The market is now basically more than 50-50 in favour of 50 basis points. So it's going to be interesting to see how the market takes it. We don't know. Do equity investors typically do well when the Fed are cutting rates?
I mean, in theory, they certainly should, but I personally, and this is based on no, you know, insight from, you know, inside the corridors of power at the Fed, just my hunch is they will say 50 basis points as a first move says too much. It's too aggressive. It's too panicky. I suspect they would rather go 25, 25, 50.
Yeah.
I think that's probably right.
Yeah.
I think we'll probably, you've got to get it to another stage, another talking shop, no doubt, and there's been some really good stuff here today. So thank you ever so much for your time, Katie.
Pleasure. Yeah, that's been great having you. Okay, no problem.
And thanks very much for joining us, and we hope to see you next time. Thanks very much.
Thank you.